time I come to St. Louis, I always read my new work, and whatever it is. And so tonight, first part, I'm going to read some prose because it's I just finished the Miles Davis memoir. It's a memoir from my point of view on Miles Davis, and I want to try some of that out on you, and then I'll read some poems after. This memoir will come out next year, and in the winter of 1998. This is from the prologue, and then I'll move into a chapter and give you a scene when I first met Miles. Miles Davis was a bona fide, certified creative genius. In his trumpet playing, many of the compositions he wrote, his ability to pick and lead other musicians in his band and outside his band also. His genius can also be measured by his ability to transform and bend the musical scene around him to his will, which he did throughout the span of a 45-year creative professional life as a musician and artist. It was he, not others, who maintained control over his creative expression. And he didn't give a fuck, to use one of his favorite expressions, about who liked the way he did things or not. It was his life to live, and he lived it on his own terms, by his own rules, Miles' rules, nobody else's. Many geniuses are like that. Preferring solitude to large crowds, they are often unsociable, as Miles was. Preferring to live in a more narrow space that they control, because it allowed them the freedom to focus full time on what they were doing. Miles was like that also. Wanted to be left alone to do his work undisturbed. And eccentric with an original mind, Miles preferred estrangement in order to be with his own thoughts and ideas, in order to cultivate and nourish them so that he could continuously produce fresh, innovative, interesting music, which he did throughout a jam-packed career. Geniuses prefer, according to Arthur Schopenhauer, soliloquy to dialogue. Miles was like this too. Listen to the music. The style in which he played with such depth of feeling was always a constant dialogue with himself. He was always speaking to and with his own muse through his compositions, fashion statements, attitude, the playing of his trumpet, and toward the end of his life, through his endeavors to express himself as a painter. All of it was directed at himself, but was a mirror of the culture surrounding him too. But mostly the art that Miles produced was a result of a constant conversation he carried on with his own inner being. His genius in the fashion statement he made throughout his life was almost as changeable and awesome as his musical genius. He was constantly initiating new fashion statements or styles with many of us following closely behind, imitating whatever he wore, running out to cop something similar, because Lord knows most of us couldn't afford what he had on his back, because it was just too rare and way too expensive. But we copied the style as best we could, tried to get that same fashion statement attitude he had up into our own. We also imitated his take no prisoner attitude, that deep hip coolness he emanated, almost ice. He had a certain edgy wariness about him, and a healthy suspicion when it came to people he didn't know. It was carried in his facial expression, an attitude which carried an element of disdain up in it, a no-nonsense demeanor that told everyone loud and clear who came into contact with it that he would take no bullshit, not an ounce of it. Miles Davis did not suffer fools lightly. And if you crossed him, you knew about it right away, immediately. He believed in instant justice. if not sooner. And he didn't discriminate between cutting his wrath loose on white folks or black folks, young or old, rich or poor. Miles was both good and evil, split, a split personality, a true Gemini. He could be very generous, funny, fun to be with, just a great spirit with an incredible ability for insight. Brilliant, but not an intellectual. His brilliance was intuitive, resided in his instincts, though in music he was highly trained. He was highly focused, concentrated, always into his own head. But boy, could he be nasty. A real problem person to deal with sometimes. Yes, he could. Real evil. He was an equal opportunity dispenser when it came to his wrath. But it was refreshing, I must admit to this, to see wrath in an African-American man doling out, doling it out to white people, especially white men. It was especially good for young African-American men like me to see growing up, because we desperately needed his example in the face of so many shuffling and head-scratching Negro Uncle Toms. So for a while there, we had a lot of people of all races walking around with deep, hip scowls on their faces who were imitating the way they thought Miles was. It was something to see. In the early night, well, no, that's it. I'm going to pick it up someplace else. I don't want to give you all this. Miles Davis was a poet on his instrument, a balladic African dance of sound, spitting out warm, round, sometimes cracked, trilling notes and chords of great and deep emotion that sometimes seemed to float or skate with blinding speed and efficiency over and through the most complex of rhythms and time signatures. That trumpet sound could also penetrate like a sharp knife entering the heart. It could also be softly muted, tender, low, but still always penetrating, and always with a deep, charged, emotional feeling. God, did he play a beautiful, haunting ballad or love song? It was his sound that made us sit up and take notice. His sound wedded to great feeling. A beautiful, strong, sensitive sound, unforgettable. It made your ears just perk up and take wings when you heard it. You knew it was him when you heard that sound. Knew him by the sound. Knew it was Miles Davis because that sound was unequal, unmatched, and totally unique. He had left the mockingbirds behind, especially when he used the mute in his trumpet, whether on up-tempo tunes or ballads. He had perfected that soliloquizing, dialoguing, conversational style when he was making love to our ears, kissing our feelings tenderly when muted, stunning us with those bright, rapid-fire bursts of rhythmic notes that penetrated our hearts with that St. Louis running style. There was a dialogue with himself, an imitation of perhaps a fast-talking, street-rapping black hustler. But in Miles's hands, it was now a great sound and style that immediately got your attention, because you knew whatever he played was going to be unusual. It always was, because that's the way his mind worked, unusually. And genius is unusual, always has been, always will be. Miles Davis was always unusual. He just didn't get that way after he became famous, but was always that way. From the beginning, all his homeboys back in East St. Louis always knew this, understood that he was odd, always a little bit different from them and everyone else, a cut above, apart, another breed. But they didn't mind. That's just the way Miles was their attitude. So they gave him space to be different all his life, but so long as he didn't step over some invisible line drawn in the sands of their minds that he and they both knew was there. Didn't step over that line and diss them, which he seldom did, because the homeboys would have made him pay if he did, because none of them weren't no poot butts. Miles knew this, so they understood one another in the way that homeboys always understood the one amongst them who is different, genius, odd, who sees things they never see, hears sounds they never hear or pay attention to, voices, car tires screeching, maybe a bird riffing a song, a lonely voice of some old black church lady singing plaintively in the dusk glow of a backwater country evening, somewhere few people know of or come to save mosquitoes or rats, relatives, a few friends, or evil white men dressed in robes carrying guns and planting flaming crosses. Trains whistling past in the night that never seem to stop. their wheels humming as they go. The roads unpaved there, dusty, empty, eerie in the coming twilight, and just before the haints come out in everybody's imagination and shut them all down. The ritual of young lovers walking down those roads, holding their hearts and dreams in their hands. But the voice of that old black woman floating up there above the shadows and trees, disembodied but whole in its essence, riding up there to cruise alongside the night birds circling from some unseen church or log cabin room, somewhere way back in the bushes, in some out-of-the-way location, hidden, the voice circling, plaintive, haunting, achingly real. And if you had the privilege of hearing that voice, perhaps you didn't follow it away as anything special, something you might imitate and relate to at some point for the rest of your life, in your own voice or on some instrument you played if you were involved in music, or a reference point you could relate your own life experience to if you were sensitive, alert, cognizant of other beautiful, necessary things happening around you besides your own navel, belly button. Your voice in a lonely, lonely old lady's voice. Your voice in a lonely old lady's voice. A song. You would know that what you heard could possibly be that special. Like you couldn't see the wisdom in an old black man's or woman's eyes because you were so busy watching their mouths chaw on some snuff or chewing tobacco, and that appalled you. So you couldn't or wouldn't have possibly seen anything special because it was beyond you. But a person like Miles Davis might have felt it, saw it, took it all in. My friend, baritone saxophonist Hamid Bluence once called Miles the biggest sponge in all the world. Knew that it was real and special, and so followed a way to use later, or in that same instant, if possible. So the people around him who sensed that he knew and saw and felt these things, knew that he had this specialness, that he had the gifts of someone unique, that he could possibly go on with those gifts and turn them into something special. These people knew this from the giddy-up, knew he saw and heard things they could never hear. So they protected him, gave him the space he needed to grow in so that he be allowed to do and be the things necessary for him as long as he gave back and didn't diss them by looking down on them, his nose all stuck up in the air as if he smelled something foul when they walked in. But he never did this, no. He never treated them in this way or stooped to an attitude that would peeve or hurt them from the elevated special place that he had helped and watched, that they had helped and watched him climb to, helped him to construct within their midst. No, he was always just one of the boys, even if they knew and he knew he was apart from them. It never got in the way. They were his oldest and best friends, even up until the day he died. The homeboys, his family, he trusted and knew them, and them him. To them, he was just Little Davis, or Junior, or Dewey, or Buckwheat, which was a term he hated because it alluded to the blackness of his skin, which he was always sensitive about until the day he died. But some of his old friends called him that anyway, despite his protestations, because that's what they were used to calling him, and that's the way it was, and that was that, and that was that. Now I want to move on and talk about when I first met him. Something first here. When I first met Miles, I had just gone to a concert with John Hicks, who's from St. Louis, great piano player, and he was supposed to play with Miles that night. Somehow he didn't play with him, and so John was mad as hell. He didn't let him play. Miles didn't let him play because Miles said he was drunk. I don't know what it was, but anyway, he didn't let him play. And so when I went back to find John, he was so pissed. He was had a bottle. He was wanted to hit Miles with, who was in the dressing room, wouldn't come out. So I said, "Come on, John, let's go, man. We don't have to do this, man. Let's get out of here." So that was he's going to be referred to in here because of the fact that John thought he dissed him. The other thing that I'm going to refer to is this white couple I saw at the Peacock Alley when these white people walked up and walked up to Miles and said, "Hi, Miles, my name is," and he said, "Fuck you," like this, you know. So I saw that, you know. And so I'm going to refer to that a little bit in here. So I didn't want you to not know what I was talking about. When I first met Miles Davis at a party of a friend of mine, the years had begun to wear down on him, and my beacon wasn't doing so hot. Plus, after he had treated John Hicks in the cavalier manner that he did, at least from John's side of the story, my respect for him had gone down quite a bit, and I didn't know whether I even liked him as a person any longer. Certainly, my hero worship of him had been diminished by what had happened to John. And although I was still listening to his music, I was more into African music at the time after my visit there in 1972. But I still loved him, loved his music, especially when I heard him play live, but some of his records were wearing on my nerves, seemed to have lost that beautiful, haunting, lyrical quality that had first drawn me to his music and to him. Maybe I was changing, and along with that, perhaps my taste and expectation about music. I don't know. I have never been entirely clear about this period of my life and where Miles fit into it. So many things were happening in the world and in my life. One thing was certain. One thing was clear and certain. I wasn't listening to Miles's records as much as I had in the past. Certainly not as much as I used to. And I wasn't waiting with bated breath for his records to be released to see what kind of new sounds he would be laying down. No, my head was somewhere else when I finally met the man. It was 1978 or 77 or 78, I think, and the meeting occurred at my late friend Dr. Leo Maitland's apartment, who happened to be one of Miles's doctors. Leo lived down the hall from me at 382 Central Park West, and we had become very good friends and stayed friends until his untimely death of a heart attack in 1992. I had seen Miles a couple of times before I met him, a few times in the elevator since he was going out with one of my former poetry workshop students, Yvonne or Yvette. I can't remember which one since they were identical twins, but I think it was Yvette Durrett, who lived in the same apartment building as I did. I had also gotten glimpses of him a couple of other times at bars, sitting in the corner looking menacingly at everyone, hidden behind his ever dark glasses. Had seen him a couple of times at after hours joints and a few other times hurrying down streets, either walking or driving his red Ferrari sports coupe. We lived in the same neighborhood on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. But the times I saw him, I never said a mumbling word to him before meeting him at Leo's apartment, because I remembered clearly how he had treated that young couple back in St. Louis and John Hicks. I didn't want that to happen to me, because if he had treated me like he treated them, I thought I would respond in a very negative manner. I thought I would have stood my ground, you know. A fight might have occurred. I don't know. So since I didn't want it to get to that level, I kept not distant from the man, not uttering a mumbling word in his direction. But that night at Leo's would change all that. And I would finally find myself up close, sitting right next to him, and before long, even talking with him for a while. When I arrived at Leo's apartment that fateful evening, the only place left open to sit was right next to Miles Davis, who was dressed as he usually was back in those days, all in black. No one, I guess, wanted to brave sitting next to him. And I didn't either, really. But I did, because there was no other place to sit down. I was surprised to see him there, really, tearing away at the food on his plate like he was. Even while eating, he managed to maintain that menacing, "don't fuck with me" at quality. He always seemed to carry around in his persona. I got some food, a drink, and sat down next to him. He kind of looked surprised that someone would be so bold enough to enter his space. Then I heard him saying that famous scratchy voice of him, "What's happening?" Nothing, I said without even looking at him, afraid he might scorch me with those hot, boring eyes, even from behind those dark shades. "Oh, yeah," he said, looking sideways at me, a hint of a sardonic grin trembling at the corner of his lips, greasy and shiny with what he was eating. "You sure of that?" he added, looking back down at his food. "Sure what?" I said, a little confused with the tone of the conversation. "That nothing's happening here. You sure of that?" "No, I'm not sure that nothing's happening. Maybe it is, but I don't see it."
Well, he said,
looking at me directly at me,
"you see that fine motherfucking bitch standing over there, don't you? You gonna tell me she ain't what's going on?"
I looked at the woman he was nodding toward and said without hesitation, "Yeah, I see what you mean. She is happening.
Tell me about it.
He said, nodding his head.
Man, that woman's finer than a motherfucker.
You got that right, I said, nodding my head in approval. Yeah, you sure enough got that right.
You a musician?
He said, looking at me curiously, chewing hard on his food, then looking down at his plate. No, I'm a poet, I told him.
No shit.
He said, looking at me again, holding my face in the twin dark mirrors of his shades before going back to his food.
A poet? No shit.
He said. Then he didn't say another word. When he got up to leave about 15 minutes later, he looked at me and shook my hand and said,
later.
That was it. He was gone, out the door, into the night air of Manhattan like a figment of my wildest imagination. I never forgot that conversation because it was so short and weird. I sensed the boxer in Miles that evening, something he desperately wanted to be at one time, an edginess that came across clearly in his music. The next time I saw Miles was about 2 weeks later, walking down Broadway on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, I think between 81st and 82nd Streets. He was coming toward me on the west side of the street, dressed in all black again, including a black hat and dark shades. I watched his mouth from a distance of about half a block working feverishly over some chewing gum, his jaws grinding up and down like almost like pistons. He was in a hurry and was moving rapidly toward me, head up, fierce expression, moving in that hip-de-dip, strut and glide, bouncy walk with a dip in the middle that was his gait, his signature. No nonsense, cool musician strut that I got to know so well much later. He was looking straight ahead, not speaking to or noticing anyone or anything but some imaginary place he held fixed in his head that focused him, that focused him. People were looking at him as they passed by nevertheless, and some whispered, that's Miles Davis, as they passed, but nobody had the courage to stop or speak. Not even a, hey, Miles. It was weird, the space that bloomed around him and locked him in. He was like a king, or at least a prince, which he already was, having been given the moniker the Prince of Darkness, and I might add light, because of his magical trumpet playing. Yes, sir, the cock of the walk, rooster bringing light and darkness, and all of us out there on the street that day with him were his subjects. Couldn't even come close to touching him, even though he was walking all alone, without bodyguards or a crown, save his attitude. But then again, that was enough, his attitude. So he didn't need bodyguards or a visible cross crown to let us know he was a king, because we all knew he was, and because he himself was his own best protection. His take-no-prisoner attitude surrounded him like a suit of steel armor. Yes, that was it. It was his attitude. It had always been his best protection. Yes, always had been. It was a little past midday, and a warm sun was smiling down and smoothing out my vibe. Since I had met him a couple of weeks back, and since he had talked to me, I thought he would remember who I was. So when he was a few feet in front of me, I smiled in anticipation, lifted my hand in greeting and said, hey, how you doing, Miles? He didn't even blink or break stride, but swept right on by, or blew by, whatever would be a better way of describing it, as if I weren't even there. Didn't say a word, nothing. Nothing but intense energy moving by through space. Perhaps that tornadic wind he likened to himself, a force of nature, dark or light. I couldn't tell that day. I was so transfixed. Didn't wave or nothing, but just kept right on stepping, moving away. I was shocked, stunned, but not rendered mute. So I called out his name again as the distance between us grew. Hey, Miles, it's me, Quincy Troupe, the poet. I met you over at Leo Maitland's. I said this to his back. But he didn't even pause, not to mention look around. Just kept right on stepping. And before I knew it, he had hooked the left, disappearing around the corner of 82nd Street like an apparition. I felt silly when he turned the corner like that, the smile wiped off my face. With egg all over my face, I sheepishly looked around to see if anyone had noticed. A few had and seemed to be snickering under smug smiles. I was embarrassed, to say the least. So I turned around and walked down Broadway, head down, my ego shattered, puzzled and angry. Why would he treat me like that, I asked myself rhetorically, even though I already knew the answer, which my cousin Marvin, now deceased, had told me long ago the first time I saw Miles up close and in person back in St. Louis's Peacock Alley. Don't speak to Miles, he had told me back then on that night. And right before Miles had embarrassed that white boy like that for speaking to him, just like he did me just now. Only I didn't get cursed out, if that's any saving grace. Miles don't like people coming up and talking to him unless he knows them real good, Marvin had told me. And he was right. I knew this. I had seen what had happened to John Hicks, had felt his energy in those bars and after-hours joints. But hard-headed me, with plenty ego to spare now, had to learn the hard way that I didn't know Miles at all, even though I thought I did after talking to him at Leo's. But that didn't even come close to qualifying me as an acquaintance, even though in my own stupid head, I probably thought I was. I ran into Miles a couple of months later, again at a party thrown by Leo. Out of anger or curiosity or stupidity, I walked right up to him while he was eating a plate of fish and asked him why he had shined me on so bad that day out on Broadway. He was alone, and without missing a beat, he fixed me with one of those fierce, almost evil looks, a look I saw many, many times later after I got to know him well, and said, "Fuck you, man. I don't have to speak to your motherfucking ass every time I see you. Shit. Who the fuck you think you are?" And with that said, he went back to eating his food. I didn't say anything, which shocked me, because I'm not the quiet type who normally lets somebody get away with talking to me in this manner. Normally, I would have said a fuck you back. Maybe even went upside the person's head for disrespecting me in such a manner. But I didn't say those words or go upside his head. I just looked at him with probably a hurt expression on my face and was silent. Stunned by the fierceness of his words. I was also more than likely suffering from a bad case of hero worship at the time, which probably also had something to do with rendering me mute. Again, the good thing is that only a few people heard what he said to me that night, and not the entire party. But those people who had heard looked at me in that smug way of disapproval when someone as famous as Miles screams on someone else less famous. Like, you know, it all had to be my fault and couldn't have been his. And why didn't I just sit my ass down and enjoy being in the man's presence without saying a word or really interacting with him as they were doing? In other words, don't shake the boat and make the celebrity mad. But I was so embarrassed again, he didn't say another word to me for the rest of the evening, the rest of the time he was there. But from time to time, I would catch him looking hard and evil at me. And I can tell you, those looks sent shivers up and down my back. Before I knew it, he was gone again, had slipped out into the night without fanfare, mysteriously, like one of his mysterious solos was suddenly there and then gone, like a wisp of smoke into the night. I didn't come in close contact with Miles for years after that, where I spoke to him. Not that I was trying to run into him either, although I would see him from time to time sliding around the darkness of bars and after-hours joints, a drinking cigarette in his hands, dark sunglasses on, usually dressed in all black and whispering in the ears of fine ladies. I did, however, run into him in the elevator of my building again. We were alone, standing side by side, but his cold demeanor told me not to approach him and anything that night, and I didn't. I had learned my lesson well by then. I remember wondering, however, if this was the way through intimidation that he whipped the musicians in his band into line. When he got to his floor, he got off the elevator without any acknowledgement of my presence. After he left, I could still feel the power of the man in that elevator, the force of that demonic spirit and personality I would get to know so well much later. That night, when he left the elevator, I was almost happy to see him go, so that I could be away from all that force I felt in his personality. But it was also this same demonic force that propelled his music into genius. The magic of it all, the power, the mystery, whatever one felt about the man, one thing I had learned was certain. Up close and personal, there was no denying the man himself was something else, with a power and presence about him that was impressive, undeniable. And whether you agree with it or not, he transferred this power into his ever-changing music. not too many, and then, you know, not too many. Excuse me. This is a weird poem. I'll tell you right now. It's called I Change Dreams. This poem was written after I moved to California from New York. And we went back there and saw some things. I love New York, but I changed dreams at 42nd Street, Times Square, as swirling people wearing technicolor attitude speed through packed days, carrying speech that machine guns out in rhythms equaling movement of averted stares. Squares even sashay by quick and flip mimicking motions as slick street hustlers roll their eyes around like marbles searching for hits, lick their chops after clicking on to some slow-witted hicks, dribbling spit down their lips, eating hot dogs paid with $50 bills in broad daylight. Yeah, tell me about it, trick. Escalator sidewalks moving everything along so swiftly everyone thinks it's their own feet carrying their bodies, grooving to a different song than, say, in Gloucester, Mississippi, where time is a turtle moving after a flood has crawled back into the space it came out of in the first place. Hear no beepers here in Gloucester, no portable telephones panicking anywhere, only the constant slow humming glide of bloated mosquitoes as they slide through air and bank in for fresh blood kills, wind tongue guiding them into the target, wobbling on their zigzag ride above bearded irises, waving sword-shaped leaves in the breeze, as if preparing to do righteous battle with anyone or something, like people living in the Big Apple, their game faces constantly in place, and they even wear them into bathrooms. So scared to death they are of running into some cold-blooded rat there, staking out their own notion of territorial space. Try keeping their fluctuating dreams up to speed, switching up each and every moment in Midtown Manhattan, manic chameleons everywhere here, changing faces at high noon, say, at 42nd Street and 8th Avenue, claustrophobic, heat-drenching crowds packed in August, locks in on flesh, cold as a triple life sentence served out at Comstock. People here switching up gears, trying to sidestep panic in the middle of slapstick dreams, and in the center of it all, a con man who looks like Swifty Lazar, the late Hollywood agent, tooling around inside a white Rolls Royce, peddling gimmicks for old false tooth legends, who looks so bizarre in public, devoid of heavy makeup, comic even, outside of their dream machines, illusions, tattered memorabilia. The con man peddles at some tacky bazaar inside a rundown building in a cobweb room where he hawks fading photographs of Zsa Zsa Gabor in her prime, before she started breaking down in front of our eyes, wearing all that weird graphic white pancake makeup over her ever-changing facelifts, masking the dreams we wear ourselves inside our switching ballistic imaginations, bewitching us here as we move through Times Square, popping with a charge of electrical currents, energy I imagine this poem having when I first start writing it. Then having to deal with how it slowed down midway through. When I hit that part about Gloucester, a third of the way down, and tried to avoid all those zigzagging mosquitoes, dive-bumming in for fresh blood kills, my direction moving all over the place after that, changing up the focus, the rhythm, the way my dipstick lines started composing themselves. At that point in time, they began making it all up as they went along, as if they were different, as if they were different musicians improvising this poem, like the Swifty Lazar lookalike, peddling old Hollywood wonders before the fall, before they became toothless legends, before they became Zsa Zsa Gabor. This Sputnik verbal drumstick, a thing to be eaten after wall, promises way more than it could ever deliver, traveling at the speed of complete bullshit, as it were. A technicolor Times Square attitude without rhyme, riding in on a broomstick, heart sick and caustic, homesick for that good old Big Apple. Charge. Now, this is another, I don't know if I read that. No, it's kind of a cold point. You want to stay in another mood. Mm-hmm. True. I live in La Jolla, California, and I wrote this poem about La Jolla. It's a beautiful place. It's absolutely gorgeous. And but you'll see what at the end of this poem what I'm trying to talk about. La Jolla. Living out here, calm, on the edge of the streaking western world, where most sunsets leave vivid stains on the thin black line, separating the Pacific from the plunging ocean of flight above it. Time stretching as a peacock's tail feather through a landscape crisscrossed with colors of bright rainbows, stitched and weaved through green light, luminous with complexions, where kite strings split in half, a swallowing blue sky leaping as blue music heard anywhere, voices buried deep in hushed distances, beneath windswept pines whose leaves serenade throughout valleys and dipping hillsides, as overhead hot air balloons cruise like great bow-headed whales swimming underneath serrated edges of bouffant gray-white clouds that look like huge battleships, and where the eye locates on the brow of some precipice, a glass house that is an atrium, and wondrous beyond all comprehensions, where the sky is a roof, the Pacific, a glittering blue veranda, swell with surfers and salt waves, terracing in one foaming wave after another. Swimmers bobbing up there like red apples in a tub at a Halloween party just offshore, while up in verdant hills golden with light, runners jog up and down streets as nervous people behind walls and signs reading armed response sit fingering triggers of shotguns, their eyes boring in tight as two just-fired bullets. That poem is about, you know, because I saw these signs, you know, and it's so beautiful, and I'd met this guy, and he didn't know why he had these shotguns. He had about 14 guns, and, you know, it's a beautiful place, and nobody, I asked him, I said, anybody ever mug you? He said, nope. I said, anybody ever break in your house? No. I said, anybody break in your son's or daughter's house? He said, no. I said, you know, if somebody breaks in your house, they're going to take that shotgun. They're going to kill you with it, with your own gun, because, you know, they're going to kill you with it. So it's just really weird to see all those signs every place. This is a poem for Charlie Mingus, and then I'll read about three or more, read three or four more, and then I'll be done through it. These are from the book, but I've never read them over here, so I wanted to read them here. One for Charlie Mingus. Who don't know, Charlie Mingus is a great bass player. Great, great bass player. Into space, time walks bass strings of Charlie Mingus, jambalaya rhythms deepening our ears. Hear voices springing from tongues of Mingus, riding sweet bass strings, deep stepping through sound, through light and shadows of blood, cut out into the leaping night. Walking music swings the wind as tongues of evening caress the flying darkness there. Inside rhythms, tight embraces of sound thumping, bass grooves lengthening the graceful flights of cadences, shading cards of voodoo. Who doing who there? Juicing mean Watts boy, sluicing shimmy down mean streets of the city of angels. When Mingus played a strange disquieting beauty, turned it on, believed in whatever he thought he was back then, played it all the way here, where I'm dreaming now, listening within this moment of musical amazement, walking in, his voice riding in through vibrating strings, thumping and humping like naked lovers inside musky, hot, steaming, rumpled backwater bedrooms, in the afterglow, under cover of damp light, in the nighttime of their dreams, Mingus skybreaking his bass through steep blue lifetimes of urban screams. Who doing what to who here? Inside the city of lights, raining tears, raining blood and blue showers, electrifying nights where Mingus walked music through voodoo, flying all the way home, thumping the rhythms. Mingus stalks the music, tone after magical tone, walks the mysterious music all the way home, tone after magisterial tone. This is a long poem. I'm just going to read a section because it's 18 pages. You know, and it's too long. You know, it's too long to read 18 pages. It's called Borders. Between the sweetness of language, as in a rush of passion, when two lovers exchange tongues in a greeting of new language, inside the furnace of their mouths, between lips, after the heat of their desires have first touched, and the creaking slowdown of endings, as when brakes are applied to worn down race cars at the end of the 500-mile Indianapolis speed chase. There are moments when time moves as an oscillator between parameters, between fields of light and darkness, when the pendulum sometimes is a glittering sharp blade swinging back and forth under some leering street lamp, or a huge wrecking ball smashing the chest of an old building. On the other hand, it could be what ears know when they hear sounds tick-tocking, that tempo is a locator of movement, as when words arc themselves across time and space to describe curved backs of sweet women straddling the flow of a lover's deep stroking. When love comes down in the secret soft places of an all-embracing night, where the music of the moment creates rhythms, washing wave after wave over fused flesh, wet and slippery as eels, swimming downstream in the ebb and flow of currents, like the soloing of a bright bird caught flying called Miles Dewey Davis III. Expression comes together to soar inside interlocking cultures as fusion explodes xenophobia into cross-fertilizations, as when words slip slyly into composition of poetry as jazz notes become elements of surprise here in their dancing, as when tap feet tap music across dance floors in a response to syncopation, answering the call of antiphonal cadences, as in the way soukha singers slide their voices into rapture, into the shifting music by way of backdoor vibrations, as if inside a seance-like trance, inside a high state of improvisation, the voice, the body voice lifting itself up to curl into worship, as heartbeat, as the song of ancestors echoing inside the drum roll of the call, voices of ancestors echoing inside drum rolls of the call, inside a hemorrhaging of 911, wails of isolation. Thanks. I'm going to read three more and then I'll be through. I love coming to St. Louis because in St. Louis, you know, I always read my new things here. And I don't read them anyplace else. You know, people will tell you and boo and tell you that ain't shit or whatever, you know. And they'll come up and tell you in the ear. They'll come up and whisper and say, that didn't work. You know? I love that, you know. Or that did work. So it's always good. This is called Two for the Piano Players at the Spruce Street Forum, which is in San Francisco. I'm San Diego. These two piano players play. Mike Wolford, who is a white piano player, really good, and Anthony Davis, who's also a great piano player. Mike Wolford set. Long-distance words peel themselves through dreams, peel themselves like bells or wind chimes, cascading crystal piano runs, waterfalling over Bösendorfer keys. Just as the fecund imagination of a solo pianist weaves a tapestry, so images sew themselves inside his tap-dancing fingers, riffing out music, caressed from black and white ivory keys, spooling out into space, a long clothesline of sound threading that reminds of a piece of silk thread fed through the eye of a needle, tunneling through our mind, our ears, before it sews everything down, inside the mind and heart, sitting at the apex of spirit, where everything is calm. Beauty coalescing inside touch, the pianist hunched over his keyboard like a poet over his paper, conjures up notes that burst sweet as cold purple grapes do inside mouths when they are perfectly ripe, in season, the place green with spring or summer, the music singing in and of itself, as fingers pull cards, as poets pull words from someplace altogether mysterious, in clusters that are seductive as language call from a place of magic is where it all begins and ends. In this moment of clear seduction, the quiet alchemized here, transformed by glorious sounds that are enchanting as the purrs of lovers, their language cooing sweetness as tongues wrap, mysterious and bright as sunbeams teasing, touch here through slats of Venetian blinds, clear as bars of music, bringing light to dark, dark rooms, Anthony Davis has said. The runs here remind of Balinese crystal geysers spraying from waterfalls, here and there foaming into dissonance, time signatures marching as time itself marches, accumulating itself as it goes, as car horns moving, honking, and blaring through traffic in Manhattan are forms of accumulation. The music here moving through space, coasting as order in chaos of Times Square moves through that space and time, mimicking motion, revealing itself in speed, in the quick change of artists, chameleon-like makeover there, beyond what caution brings to the table, but up into symmetry anyway, and is what it is here. Nothing more or less but the sum total of rhythm, what sound brings to our ears, our notion of the limits of artistry is what it is here. Nothing less than energy moving itself forward or backwards or sideways like a sidewinder rattlesnake, black and white keys running tension over themselves, through themselves. Here everything mixed up as patois, spirits as mestizo, mulatto sounds, gumbo, jambalaya, American sounds, stewing in the black iron pot of Meltdown. Figures repeating themselves over and over again, like trilling birds chirping somewhere deep in forest time, deep as in a choir of birds mimicking Thelonious Monk himself. Syllables spraying foam and disjunctive chords after a waterfall hits rock, after a headlong plunge through space. The music cascading post-haste, like hip speech does when it wears dark shades, dresses up its words with hip shirts, shoes, and trousers. The music here scatting post-bop, the pianist's hands bent at the wrist like a swan feeding, its graceful long neck curved in the shape of arching fingers, tiptoeing up and down over keys like Bojangles Robinson, flashing now over the piano's black and white smile in a blur, leapfrogging music, spewing from cards, echoing bird calls, once heard in a Munich English flower garden, once heard in the eye-popping runs of Art Tatum. The music transporting here in San Diego, like alchemy, going down smooth as a grand meal with great wine. The OJ thing. The OJ ordeal was like a three-year-old nightmare, stuck to our senses like dripping hot glue of that old black tar baby legend. When black folks found Juice innocent, it was racial. But when white folks found him guilty, it was plain old justice, nothing more or less. Back in old days, white folks would lynch a nigger, would lynch niggers, hang them like strange fruit in trees. Now they lynch black pocketbooks, lynch us in their media. Is that what it is? Your sore spot of anger that you can't send lynch mobs anymore to string up Juice so you don't feel real closure? Now you want to take even his children from him because they love him and him them. Better they see the cold slaughter from afar. What will we say one to another, white, black years down the bloody road? How explain to young ones, speak to them, wearing straight faces? Can we speak freedom without knowing what it is? Freedom without love or forgiveness. What is it we're all talking about now? If we know race was invented in Europe, what truth do we speak of now when all we see around us is rainbow of nature? Leave the man alone with his children. Let him go with them through their lives. Wish they bloom into flowers, bright as love until they die. Now Juice is myth, way past what we thought he was. Crucified for white revenge, nailed to a public cross like Jesus, Malcolm X. And I want to leave you, I don't want to leave you with this poem. It's not finished yet. None of these are finished yet. These are ongoing projects because I write a lot, you know. I rewrite a lot. I read that poem in San Diego and everybody wanted to, people wanted to lynch me almost. But they don't understand that people have different opinions, you know. You know, they have different opinions and people can say what they want, you know. You know, there's this house across from me. Where I live, it's a beautiful house, and it's like it's across from me, and I never see this person. I've never met him. You know, they just live right across the road from me. But it's a long distance. You have to understand. You have to understand the distance. I mean, some people do. You know, just used to it. And it's a kind of a distance across from me, and so I'm always looking at this window, and I want to close with this poem because I'm just now finishing it and it's being rewritten. So I'm going to just try it here. And I'm looking at this house, you know, and I'm looking. I don't know who's there, and but are we all looking at things from our own perspectives. So it's called Looking Out Between Thinking. I wanted my work to change. That's one of the reasons I moved to California. I wanted to be different. I think, you know, Miles Davis was a great mentor for me, that you're supposed to push the envelope or try to push the envelope. Looking out between thinking. I am scoping out a green hillside across from me, altogether speechless. Looking out between thinking through a clear, cool pane, spotted with old raindrops that did not go away, but left behind their fingerprints here, marks, what have you, blemishes on a face filled with freckles, bursting sores festering of glass. A window like someone else's, perhaps, who is looking at me from the other side of the road, their eyes zeroing in now, even as I speak through this poem. Their pain made visible there, somewhere I can't even begin to speak of now, or know why, how, or where, though I know it's there also, like mine here. Because I'm looking out through it, even as I speak to you, O great poetic muse. Feel it at this precise moment, as I look at the green hillside across from air, where the trees are stretching above their own waving shadows, above the house with the built-in window through which someone might be looking at me now, through their own pain, built into that almost green hillside that is shimmering, touched with yellow or gold here and there. I watch light glancing off edges like razors nicking flesh, lances of sun rays streaming in with shadows through my window. A tonguing wind wagging leaves of trees leads them in a form of song dancing as spring begins hinting its measured approach, slowly putting on festive clothes one by one, a bud opening here, a robe of geraniums there. Colors of rainbows sprung from someplace deep beneath the earth is suddenly here, like a song heard achingly beautiful in passing, glides and floats, real as a bird banking through the air like a rift from Kind of Blue or Human Nature. Music always filling up there, filling up distance, looking out between thinking, holding on to whatever blooms here and that's in whatever blooms in that space. Polyphonic voices sluiced through interpretations, miles measuring time, travel here to there. Whatever fills up imagination is what we bring to the moment, held up to light for scrutiny. These prisms we are looking through now, my eyes penetrating the pain I am carrying here as I look through it to the other side of the road to see light glancing off the window panes of that house built into that hillside there, almost shimmering green, where bold-flecked yellow heads of flowers grow dazzlingly, popping from green bushes into my vision. They are suddenly scattered there, all over the hillside, moments sprinkled like gold. Thank you.